This is Mayo Clinic Kids, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we discuss the latest pediatric research and recommendations to help keep your kids laughing and thriving. I'm Dr. Angela Matke, a pediatrician with Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. This episode, getting kids back on track post-pandemic. Almost 4 years after lockdown started, a lot of parents have noticed their kids were struggling in school. And it brings up a question, is this because of 2 years of distance learning, or is there something else going on? For example, here's what Caden and his parents were dealing with.
This is actually a colleague of mine. Her son Caden was in preschool when the pandemic hit, and Caden spent his entire kindergarten year remote. And so my colleague continued to work with them every day. They spent all of kindergarten working on it, supporting when he was learning at school, and every day that summer. And right away in first grade, they saw that it wasn't clicking and sticking. So first grade was back in person, and Caden was flagged early on and was put in reading intervention in first grade. And that entire year, again, gains and progress wasn't happening. And so they came to the summer going into second grade, and school said same thing as what they had been doing. We want you to practice every day this summer, and you know there's still plenty of time to catch up. Don't worry. My friend was in panic mode at this point because they had already been doing this for well over a year, and she was scared to death that second grade was going to look just like first grade if they didn't do something different, where repetition and one-on-one wasn't changing it. And she didn't know, was this because of the pandemic? Was it because Caden had kindergarten remote, but then the catching up just wasn't happening?
The COVID-19 pandemic was a rough time for all of us, but especially kids. They went from sitting in a classroom surrounded by friends to being alone in their rooms, sitting on their beds with a laptop. Screen time rocketed, and so did stress. As parents, we did our best to keep our kids from getting sick, but these dramatic lifestyle changes really had their impact, whether you're 18 hours old or 18 years. Now, 4 years after quarantine and a chaotic pivot to remote learning, we're starting to feel and really measure COVID's impact on childhood development. We see more infants struggling with motor skills, more students underperforming academically, more teens struggling with anxiety and depression, and we'll probably be feeling those effects for years to come. But the good news is, as a parent, there's things you can do to help and actively foster a return to healthy development. That's why we're talking to Dr. Rebecca Jackson. She's a cognitive specialist and the VP of Programs for Brain Balance, an organization that helps kids strengthen and build brain connectivity. And she's the author of a new book from Mayo Clinic Press, Back on Track, that guides parents to help their kids recover from pandemic-related developmental delays. So Rebecca, sometimes we hear terms that are so frequently used that we actually forget what they mean. What do you mean specifically when you say child development?
So much, right? The brain and bodies and humans are incredibly complex. But when it comes to development, these are networks and pathways in our brain that refine and become more complex over time so that we're able to do more complex things over time. Whether it's physical movements where a baby starts super simple with rolling over, sitting up, and then walking. Think about, you know, we've got to have balance and then the coordination to lift up one foot without tipping over and use the other. So it starts with physical in so many ways. That's what's so easy for us to observe and experience as parents. But there's so many layers. Our movements, our actions, our thoughts and reactions can become more complex. And so our social development doesn't start with great abilities to read nonverbal social cues and you know, enormous empathy. Early on, it's looking at that ability to make a connection, that ability to instigate. You know, I love watching playing peekaboo with an infant. They're making eye contact with you. They're smiling at you to capture that attention. Those are some really early social developmental pieces that we want to see continue to build from there. And one of the things that we notice often is in older students that may have a hard time making and keeping friends, they might be struggling with that ability to read nonverbal social cues. And so if a child isn't picking up on some of those social cues, it's not a time to panic. It's a red flag to look a little bit more closely
to see, is there something going on in that underlying foundational development that's making an aspect harder than what it needs to be? And then I think when it comes to emotional development, how we handle our frustrations and upsets, all of us lose our temper. All of us have a breaking point that I always say the cliff that we fall off the edge of. And it's always a question of how far are we away from that cliff? Is it any little thing is going to set us off and a meltdown is going to occur? Or are you resilient and you can handle the ups and downs? The more mature the brain is, the better we can handle those ups and downs. And so if you have a child that's melting down more frequently, if those upsets are lasting longer and taking longer to recover from, that again can be a sign of some immaturity in that social, emotional, and that regulation development. And again, it's okay for a 15-year-old to get upset. It's looking at what is an age-appropriate response and expectation at various ages.
So we've got physical development, social development, and emotional development all kind of going on at the same time and complementing each other. What about language development? What sort of milestones should we be looking for there?
Again, you know, we want to see consistent and steady progress. We don't expect an infant to be coming out with five-word sentences, but we want to see that babble early on. And then we want to see that consistent and steady gain and progress so that the babbles become close approximation to words. And then you start to hear sounds at the beginning and end of the word. So ball goes from b to ball over time, and then starting to string multiple words together. And what we can see is, you know, when we think about having a conversation, we have to formulate the thoughts in our head and get them out. And we can see this in older kids. If I'm picking a child up from school and they've had a long day and they're exhausted, and I pounce on them and say, tell me all about your day. How was math class? Who did you sit with at lunch? What did you do at recess? But for a child that has to work harder to organize the thoughts and get the thought from in their head out, that takes more energy and effort. And something that's hard for a child, if they're tired, is going to become even harder. So one of the things that I look for in language pieces with an older child is that reticence to talk and share. So that's a piece to keep in mind for some of our older students when it comes to language and communication.
I love that example. You know, I know a lot of kids that are like that at the end of the day. You know, they're tired, they're exhausted, they're pooped, and their energies are just really low. And we just need to give them that time and space to just decompress from the end of the day. Okay, so we've got a sense of the different kinds of development and their milestones. Now, what does your child need to be able to develop consistently and healthily?
To me, two of the most important things that I've seen in my work is sensory input and physical movement. Our sensory system is what allows us to engage with the world, to read nonverbal social cues, to listen to traffic if I'm about to cross a busy road to know a bus is coming, to feel the warm sun to know what to wear that day. Our sensory system orients us and allows us to take in information. It is critical to learning. And so when there's any sort of disruption or dysregulation in our sensory system, it can make things more challenging. And so the student might have a harder time listening and following along in the classroom, blocking out the noise of the students next to them to focus on what the teacher's saying. They might have a harder time with attention and focus, a higher likelihood of anxiety. If you can't trust and process the information that your brain is giving you, there can be a lot of complications. And so providing our kids at all ages a lot of sensory input that is varied, so something different, but then you want to repeat it over and over and over again to exercise and strengthen the pathway that processes that information. So sensory to me is huge. And then the other piece is that physical movement. Exercise is so good for the brain and body on so many levels. And our core muscles activate and engage the brain to increase our arousal and level of alertness so that we're taking in more information. And so using movement to help to foster both healthy development as well as attention and memory is just a great strategy that parents can implement easily from home, just keeping that in mind.
And I would add in that both of these things that you talked about are things that occur organically during play. And I think one of the most important things parents get really into buying the right kind of toys, and they have to be like super expensive and these different types of things. But what children really need is unstructured free play and space and time to be able to do it. And having that parent, that plays with them or other children that play with them that allow them to learn all these developmental milestones through trial and error. You know, they learn their gross, their fine motor skills, their social emotional communication, their compromise and their ability to navigate complex conversations and have to sometimes not get what they want and have to then go along with a non-preferred activity. And so I think there's in our society such a movement towards making sure that we have every single part of our child's day structured. Young kids need unstructured free play. School-age children need unstructured free play. We all need that unstructured time in our brain to be able to do preferred activities and also learn and engage in new ideas. And so I'm constantly advocating and giving prescriptions in my office about, I want you to keep playing, to keep your body strong and powerful, because those are the parts that allow their brain to develop those neural connections like you were talking about.
I absolutely love that. And that's one of the things that we saw impacted so significantly during the pandemic was her structure and our routines changed so drastically. And so while there might have been less structure in some ways when kids weren't going to school in person, they were home, but there was less variation. So, you know, in our neighborhood for a long time, kids weren't even playing outside with other kids. And so my own kids could go outside, but they weren't interacting with others. And that sensory environment didn't change for them. We stopped bringing our kids to Target. We stopped bringing them to the grocery store. We stopped going over to friends and family's houses. And so their sensory input was like Groundhog's Day, right? It was the sound of our own dogs, the smell of our own house. We cooked the same meals over and over. They were on sensory repeat. And so we cut off exposure, and the brain grows through challenge and new. And so there was just so much less challenge, and they missed out on a year of those playground life lessons, like you referenced. And so our kids had this gap where those just organic life experiences were muted for a period of time, and we're seeing the ramifications and impact of that.
Pregnancy is an important time in our lives, full of thrills, unknowns, critical decisions, and big celebrations. You don't have to navigate any of those moments alone. In the book, you'll get the latest expertise from Mayo Clinic specialists, month-by-month chapters, milestones to watch for, and key steps in your prenatal care. Get your copy of Mayo Clinic Guide to a Healthy Pregnancy today at mcpress.mayoclinic.org and use code KIDS for 10% off your order. That's KIDS for 10% off your order.
So development means building networks and pathways in our brain that allow us to do more complex things over time. Kids will develop different skills at different ages, but the most important thing is that they're making progress. And to do that, kids need a variety of sensory experiences and regular physical activity. But then there was this big disruption of COVID. As Dr. Jackson just said, the pandemic shrunk our kids' sensory environment, but that wasn't the only challenge. So March 2020, kids are almost at the end of their school year, and then the pandemic hits and kind of blindsides us all. What sort of effect did that have on our kids' daily lives? And what do we know now about the impact of those disruptions?
Universally, we had a time of heightened stress, facing massive amounts of change in a short amount of time, facing unknowns, and then changing our day-to-day structure and operations. Kids do best with routine and structure and knowing what to expect. And that rug got pulled out from under all of us. And so, you know, mom, am I going to go to school next week? I don't know. Maybe. Fingers crossed, but we'll see. And, you know, that just watching how we had to navigate so many unknowns. Our kids were missing friends, missing routine, missing structure. Our little ones didn't know what they were missing. But again, we changed how we operated out of necessity and out of unknowns. So we did what we needed to do based on the information we had. There should be no guilt about that. But then understanding why a reduction in sensory input, why a reduction in physical activity and social interactions did have an impact on our kids. And seeing that virtual learning wasn't as effective as in-person. And in fact, the standardized tests looking at math and reading saw the biggest backsliding we had had in decades, the lowest we had been testing in, I believe it was in math ever. And in reading, it was like a 30-year backslide in progress. And the hard part is it wasn't universal. Our low socioeconomic areas, our higher concentration of minority families were hit even harder. And so areas that sometimes have fewer tools and resources were struggling even more. We're going to continue to unpack this and learn for decades. And I think it's important to understand how draining and taxing stress and change is on the brain. It's harder to pay attention. It's harder to manage your mood and emotions when you're tired. And so to me, I feel like the pandemic was the catalyst or the amplifier of all things. If you already struggled a little bit with anxiety, it became larger. If you struggled to pay attention, it became harder. It brought existing concerns to the surface. And then coming out of the pandemic, we are seeing increased rates in ADHD, in anxiety, in suicide, in teens and even younger students. There are some very real ramifications that, again, we're still beginning to understand. And I think there's layers to this. I don't think there's one straightforward answer, but we're seeing an increase in what I would describe as immaturity in our social, emotional, and executive functions. So our kids had a gap in some foundational developmental pieces, but yet their bodies still continue to grow. And our expectations of what it looks like to be a fifth grader has remained the same. And so our kids are facing these executive function moments of get your homework done and turn it in, face challenges and frustrations and don't melt down. So we're putting less mature kids in the same environment and expecting the same from them. And so the downstream effect is I'm seeing a lot of struggles with those higher level brain functions of regulation, attention, emotions, those areas.
So kids got less exposure to things, less time with friends, less routine, less structure. But there's one thing they got a lot more of, and that was screen time. And it's something I hear a lot from parents in my office. You know, their kids were using screens all the time during the pandemic and summer vacation. And then suddenly their kids are irritable and they're emotional and they're reactive. And I always say screens are a part of our life. Like, I'm not saying you can't do them, but I'm trying to teach you regulation. And so you're not becoming addicted and having these brain pathways that become really, really harmful. So why do we see increasing escalation of behaviors in children with increasing amounts of screen time, especially those with more kind of violent or less pro-social behaviors?
It's easy to forget how taxing on our system playing a video game really is. It's not just using our traditional attentional systems, but it's like a hyper-focus. So they are using more resources than you would to do something like pay attention in math. So when a child is spending several hours on technology, whether it's scrolling YouTube or playing video games, they're burning through their attention resources quickly. And one of the things I say all the time is a tired brain is a negative brain. And so you are going to get pushback when you say, hey, it's time to turn it off, not just because they want to keep playing, but because they've run out of the resources to control their attention, their emotional regulation, and their behaviors. So as parents, we can't expect our kids to make great decisions, especially in that moment they lose sense of time. All of us do when we're in that hyper state of focus. So we need to make the decisions for them to say, hey, it's time to get off. And then really sandwiching that with physical activity before and after can help to kind of recharge and re-energize the brain, but keeping it to small doses so that we don't run out of resources.
This might be a little bit of a philosophical semantic question, but we're saying that most kids in, you know, reading and other areas have been delayed or we haven't seen the progress that we would have expected. Is the question now, should we just reset the bar? And so that's saying that no one is delayed since everyone's kind of in the same boat and a little bit behind because of the loss in academic progress during the COVID pandemic.
So could we reset the bar on academic expectations? Yes, potentially. But we can't reset the bar on what anxiety looks like, on what struggling with social emotional development looks like. I can't change the fact that your body is 10 years old, but in some ways, your social emotional development might be like that of an 8-year-old, which might increase your anxiety. We can't change that. And that impact of anxiety or struggle is so real for every child impacted and every family supporting that child. So to me, it's not about resetting the bar. It's about education and knowledge and insight. So knowing, can we provide kids with more in the way of sensory stimulation, more in that way of exercise and movement? And let's layer it. Let's make it complex. We need lots of networks and pathways in the brain to all fire simultaneously together so that you can sit in a classroom to listen and block out distractions and remember information and take notes. The brain needs to be able to perform at a high level. And I don't want to have to change the environment for a child to be successful. I want a child or an adult to be able to walk into any environment and be successful. So I think we need to change the bar on our understanding and how we're providing tools for support. That's where I think the change needs to come.
We all did our best to improvise our way through COVID, but it was tough. And the stress and disruptions made normal developmental challenges even more extreme and harder to overcome. Maybe there's a little comfort in knowing that, to some extent, we're all in the same boat. Everyone's feeling a little bit behind. But this also means that now, more than ever, kids need our support. So, Rebecca, if your child is behind in their development, can they get back on track?
Absolutely. And again, that's the hope and the happy in this story. A huge focus in science over the last several decades has been the idea of neuroplasticity, which means the brain is able to change. And in fact, our brain changes all the time. But we can be really purposeful in what we're doing so that we're exercising and strengthening the pathways that support development. We strengthen what we use. So when we're playing tons of video games, we're strengthening the pathways that hyperfocus for a short amount of time and need a reward to stay focused. So if we're spending a lot of time that way, you're strengthening those pathways versus spending a lot of time doing something like sitting in a math class that requires sustained attention without rewards. So the brain is able to be strengthened and improved. And when that happens, networks and pathways in the brain become faster, more efficient, and they have better endurance. So you can continue doing the same thing for longer, more effectively. So absolutely, the brain can catch back up.
If a family is concerned about their child's development, what are those first steps they should take and people that should be involved in that discussion about their child's development?
Trust your parent instinct, your caregiver instinct. Nobody knows your child better than you. And then the next thing is start to ask questions. Talk to your physician, talk to your teacher, talk to your child. And then if they have the developmental ability to express it, they can often tell you. Caden, in our example earlier, could say, "Mom, I can do math. Why can't my brain do this?" Caden understood what his struggle was. He just didn't know what to do to help it. So trust your parent instinct, ask questions, and then do an assessment. Caden was exceptional at math, still is, and he could feel the difference. And his assessment showed struggles with inhibitory controls. His attention was good, sustained attention, but impulsivity was high, and struggling with some visual, spatial working memory, with some eye tracking and processing, and being able to put a plan in place to support how his brain was working was able to really help him catch up. And by the end of second grade, he was testing in the top third percentile for reading. And so chances are Caden would have been struggling with the reading anyway, but that year of remote learning gave him less classroom support and exposure to help. To me, power is knowledge. And so the more we understand about your child and about their development, the more of an opportunity you have a better understanding as to why you're seeing what you're seeing and knowing what to do to support it. And there's a lot of different approaches with that. There's professionals and organizations everywhere that take a look at development to provide more insight and understanding.
What are some activities and habits that you can help build into your family's daily routines to help keep your child and your family on track?
We can't take for granted or underestimate the importance of what we do on a daily basis. And so having really healthy routines can help set our kids up for success every day going forward. If our kids are staying up too late, if they're not getting a good amount of sleep for their age, they're going to have a harder time paying attention and controlling their behaviors. And it's especially easy to get off track when we're on vacation or on holiday, but we want our kids to be on their best behavior. We can't expect great behavior and great output if we haven't set them up for success and getting good sleep. The same with nutrition. What we put into our body is what fuels our body for performance. So again, for a parent to set your child up for success, if you're about to go out for dinner and you want great behavior, having your child order a soda at dinner probably isn't the ideal strategy
for sitting still and engaging in conversation at the table. So it doesn't mean that sweets aren't okay as a treat here and there, but think about the timing for that. Sugar is going to spike the energy and then crash the energy. And so maybe it's best to save it for a sweet treat after dinner and then go outside and run around. And then working physical activity into our daily lives. I talk to my kids about it all the time, is we use our muscles to turn on our brain. So if we're about to sit down and do homework, it's, hey, why don't you go for a quick walk around the neighborhood, grab the dog and go for a walk, turn on your brain so you can focus. So that helps us to get the most out of that time. So those are simple strategies to optimize our current abilities. And then also working to minimize stress. Stress is going to chip away at all of our current abilities. And then for the long-term growth and gains, it's being really intentional about building the networks and pathways in the brain that support the higher level pieces.
Sometimes screen time use creeps up without families realizing it. How do you recommend families reset in those situations and really set those boundaries and be able to stick to those limits when their child is pushing back?
I've got a 13 and a 15-year-old. This is a conversation we have daily and weekly. And one of the things that we talk about often in our household is we're always learning new information. So sometimes we are going to change the rules. We are going to change our conversation based on the new information that we have. So maybe originally we said 2 hours on the weekend was okay, but now with more information, let's revisit that conversation. And so now let's take a look at how are we spending those 2 hours. Social media is okay. We can't vilify these things. We need to try to work together with our kids because it already feels like a power struggle. So how do we work together? So, you know, with my 15-year-old daughter, it's saying, okay, what are your priorities? What's important to you with how you use your phone? And the social piece, Snapchat is a big deal to her. And so then we need to say, okay, so if you want to reserve time for Snapchat, then you don't have time for TikTok and YouTube and these other things. And we need to make sure that the school pieces and the chores and responsibilities are taken care of first. So this is a privilege that we earn, and it's something that we balance. And we are learning every day, both of us, both child and adult, as we navigate this.
Yeah. So you talked about how important many different types of sensory experiences are for brain development and developing pathways and continuing to develop all their different milestones. But you've also talked about how important routine and structure is for positive child development and emotional regulation. So how do you balance the two of those as a parent by providing appropriate amount of sensory input and experiences, but not overloading them and not sabotaging the routines that we all know that can be really challenging as a parent?
You know, I think one of the things that's really helpful to understand is knowing how the brain processes a new experience. Let's say I'm going to a baseball game at a professional stadium for the first time. My brain doesn't know what to expect. So my brain is going to take in and process as much information as I can because I don't know what's important and what's relevant. So I'm going to process everything. So a new experience for our child is going to be draining and exhausting because they're taking in more information. But then doing that same thing over and over and over again. So let's say you go to a baseball game every Saturday for a summer. Now your child's brain is going to know what to expect. They're going to know what's important to watch, what they don't need to process and pay attention to. So their brain is now going to conserve energy and resources. So it's not going to be as draining and exhausting for them. So what's helpful to know with our kids is we do want to provide them with a new experience, but then we want to repeat that experience so that it becomes familiar and comfortable with the brain. And that's going to strengthen the pathways that process that information. So maybe as a family, you've got a set routine during the week. Here's what we do when we wake up in the morning. Here's our after school routine. And maybe once a week, we do something different in the evening. Tonight, we're going to go to a new park and we're going to explore a different park. And then on the weekend, we're going to, you know, make a fun, maybe an ethnic dinner at home, a meal that you haven't had before. Or maybe we're going to do dinner and not use utensils. And then you're going to do that a few more times. So finding an opportunity once or twice within your schedule to do a new experience and then finding opportunities to repeat that experience will build that comfort and familiarity. So you still get to balance that structure and routine so kids know what to expect while building and strengthening new experiences and pathways.
What about for kids that struggle with new experiences and new sensory opportunities where they can be too much for those kids and they start to shut down emotionally? What tips would you give to families to help prepare for those experiences?
I think first and foremost as a parent is to understand what's happening. And so knowing that your brain has done that experience before, so it's not exhausting to your brain. It's a different experience for your child. So if you understand how draining and exhausting that is, that will help you prep for it. So maybe you're going to a family birthday party and you know that there's going to be a lot of people there and that's going to be a big sensory experience. So maybe you're going to go, but you're only going to stay for 15 minutes this week. And so you're going to go, you're going to see the chaos, the people, you get to hug all the people that you want to love and have a piece of cake. And then you're going to leave when it's still a positive experience. And so start in small doses, repeat that over and over and slowly build and grow from there. And then watch for opportunities to do a sensory break. So if you see your child starting to amp up or you see it's a good opportunity, grab your child, go outside and just take a few minutes to go for a walk or sit down in a quiet room and just sit together or read a book. Look for opportunities to give a break to that sensory overload so that you can experience that opportunity or that experience for longer, more successfully. So small doses, repeat, gradually build over time and understand how truly draining it is.
So what's the end goal with all this? How do we know we've done a good job supporting our kids?
You know, for me, it's mental well-being. You know, straight A's are lovely. However, you don't need straight A's to be successful in life. That ability to form deep and meaningful connections and relationships, that ability to be able to set and achieve a goal, those are pieces that contribute to our fulfillment. To find something that you're passionate and excited about, to give your life purpose and excitement. And I think it's important for parents to know and understand for ourselves as well as our kids, making sure that we're getting enough sleep, making sure that we're providing our brain with the best fuel sources. Those are things that impact our well-being, our mood, emotions, and energy and productivity on a daily basis. And then long-term, that taking the time to build and foster friendships, the sensory exposure, the movement for all ages is good for the brain. And so hoping that we can equip our kids with those lifelong lessons of knowing how important exercise and movement is for the brain, taking time to form connections with friends so that you have those meaningful pieces to lead towards those fulfillment pieces and the well-being.
Rebecca, this has been such a great discussion. I, as a parent, have learned so much today, and it just re-energizes me about all the things that we can do to help support our families and also the children in our communities as well. So I wanted to thank you so much for giving us your time, but also, do you have any other kind of final words to sum up like all of the wisdom that you shared with us today?
I think as parents, it's just so important to know that if you're seeing your child struggle, change is possible. And I think it's important for parents to know that your child doesn't need a label or diagnosis for the struggle or challenge to be real. There's struggles and challenges that happen every day. And sometimes they're enough to warrant a label or a diagnosis, and sometimes they're not, but it doesn't make it any less real. And so recognize that, know that you're not alone, and know that there's tools and support and things to help create positive change for the life of your child and your family.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. Even during normal times, kids have so much going on. Their bodies are growing, their brains are growing, they're trying to figure out how to process information, express their thoughts and feelings, and understand the thoughts and feelings of other people. And the stress and disruption of COVID made all that hard work even harder. So now, lots of kids are showing signs of developmental delays. And if you're worried about your kid, consider getting a professional assessment. But there's lots of things you can try to do at home too, like being intentional about screen time, encouraging physical activity, trying new things, and eating healthy foods. With a little extra love and support, we can help our kids live full, healthy lives and make strong connections with the people around them. For more practical advice, you can order a copy of Dr. Jackson's book, Back on Track, at mcpress.mayoclinic.org.
That's all for this episode. But if you have a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. And we might even feature your voice on the show. For more Mayo Clinic Kids episodes and resources, check out our website at mayoclinic.org/kids. Okay, thanks for listening.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.